Hello, I'm Alistair Benn, and welcome to this week's Reaction podcast. I'm joined by Reaction editor Ian Martin and Maggie Pagano, our executive editor.
Hi.
Hello, and we're recording this in the new Reaction office in Westminster. So if there are some sort of office noises off stage, please ignore them. But we're sort of close to the heart of the action, hopefully, exactly. In Westminster.
It's just the printing presses going to action. So if you like what you hear, please subscribe to our website. That's www.reaction.life, and you can read all the great writing that we produce there. It's just £5 a month, and you get real value for money. In the last week, we published a long read on the West's silence over China's treatment of the Uyghur. We have loads of great art stuff that goes out on a Saturday. This week, an essay on Steve Reich and Gerhard Richter, a beautiful piece on the long decline of Scottish football, and a wonderful travelogue from Rome, and lots more. But this is an election special podcast. We're going to start off with quite a simple question. Which party has most room for improvement from where we are at the moment and all the polling that we've seen? Ian, can you kick us off?
Well, you could argue that it's the Labour Party, because Jeremy Corbyn is in a situation that no leader of the opposition, or since Michael Foot in the 1983 election, has a Labour leader been in such a perilous position. Although you could say that Corbyn was in a bad position in 2017, even worse now, in terms of his personal ratings and where the party are. So the Labour Party could, again, and this is the thing which of course terrifies the Conservatives, the Labour Party could, during the election campaign, start to benefit from a return to tribalism effect if sufficient numbers of voters conclude that really this is a straight fight. We'll talk about the Lib Dems in a minute, but it's ultimately a straight fight over who you want to become Prime Minister, Boris Johnson or Jeremy Corbyn. So in that sense, the Labour Party has the Labour Party has the most to do, but could surprise on the upside.
What do you think, Maggie?
Well, I disagree with that, and I would say that the Conservatives have the most to play for, because if you take away Brexit, very few of us know what their actual political philosophy is, and I think that's the missing hole in their thinking, other than, if you like, these mantras, get Brexit done, spend more on NHS and police. That's all we've heard, really, and underneath, I think there's this big gap. And they have been in power for 9 years, and I think that their ask is, why should we, again, take away Brexit, why should we vote for them again? There are so many missing things that we complain about, that they complain about. Lack of housing, homelessness, not enough spending. Well, you know, it's very, you can tip the argument and say, well, okay, so why haven't you done more about it?
Well, I think their problem, though, is the Tories, and this explains why they didn't, since we last recorded this podcast, the last edition, of course, quite a bit has happened, and they've charged ahead with an election rather than pushing through the withdrawal agreement bill. Mm. Now, at the time, certain people, I was one of them, questioned why they were doing that, and I thought that they should have had a go at trying to get Brexit done in the current parliament, or the parliament's just been dissolved. The reason that they've pushed ahead is, I think, precisely for the reason that Maggie says, in that the Tories are terrified of the election that there has to be at some point being not about Brexit. So the concern for them was that they would end up in a situation where they delivered Brexit, Britain leaves the European Union, and then there has to be an election, and the election is in, say, spring next year. Brexit's kind of a done deal. Of course, there's an argument about future trade. However, it then becomes about the state of the public realm, and the Tories, I think, know that's why they've tacked towards higher public spending, obsession on police numbers, crime. They know that they are overdue a kicking after almost 10 years in power.
And I was going to say, and Labour have almost an insanely detailed manifesto offer on the economy. They've got about 300 policies, whether it's fiddling around with stamp duty or different rates of tax or kind of more soft, you know, bigger things like nationalisation.
Yeah.
But
sorry, Alistair, I interrupted you. You were going to respond to the question, to your own question.
Who has the most
to gain?
I think The Tories have, well, it kind of depends, at the moment it depends where you look in England, Wales and Scotland, and in all the different constituent regions, and even within England, there are almost a completely different set of questions that you need to ask. So in Wales, I think the Tories have a massive opportunity to get about, I think, around 9 or 10 seats, given that I think Boris Johnson's personal polling in Wales is insanely high compared to the rest of the country, and Corbyn's is as low or lower than it is in the rest. Plus, the Tories for a long time, at the last election, they did better in Wales than they have done off the back of kind of a degree of Euroscepticism there is in Wales that there isn't in Scotland, for whatever reason. And I think Labour are suffering maybe a similar thing that happens in Scotland, where they've been seen as the kind of to have dominated Labour politics for almost 100 years, and where they're potentially failing to come up with fresh answers to the big constitutional questions of, you know, on identity, with Plaid kind of on the left as well. So in Wales there's that side of it, and then in the Midlands you're probably going to see, if the Brexit Party stands, you might see the Brexit Party doing better by taking up, might help the Tory vote by taking seats off Labour, by driving down the Labour vote. But then in the north, in kind of key seats like Warrington, the Brexit Party votes would split the Leave votes catastrophically for the Tories, and would deliver people like Gloria Del Piero back into Parliament, even though they're effectively standing on a Remain ticket. And then in the south, you've got a different set of questions. Will the Lib Dem vote split Labour, or will it be a Remain alliance? Will the Tories be able to sustain this notion that they're the compromise Brexit party when they're seen as insane by quite a large portion of the population? And then in Scotland, you've got, I think Tories will actually do slightly better in Scotland because of the unionist element, because they're just, because Labour are nowhere, and they'll, I think, hang on to maybe 3 or 4 of the seats rather than 10 to, you know, I think it was 10 or 11 at last time.
Yeah, the Tories, but the Tories are a bit cheerier. The Scottish Tories seem to strike me the last few days as a bit cheerier than they had been, but these things are all relative. That's because I think they think they're only going to lose about half their seats. But they might surprise on the upside, because the weird thing, and it is a, it's a weird situation in Scotland, because Scotland's not just a marginal, doesn't just have marginal constituencies in it, it's basically a marginal country, and there are so many seats that are 3 and sometimes 4 way marginals that people are maybe going to win with 27-28% of the vote. So in those circumstances, weird things could happen to the benefit of, well, any of the parties, but could surprise on the upside for the Tories if they reactivate or activate the Leave vote in Scotland, which is more than 1 million people voted to leave. Now, some of them, of course, are Scottish nationalists, but it's not that difficult to imagine. I know some listeners in Scotland will think that this is sounds ludicrous, but something to look out for beyond all the nationalist hype is the Tories playing a data game that unlocks maybe 150, 200,000 more leavers than people anticipated in strange places, and they might they might surprise in a few seats.
And we're often talking, because of the 3 or 4 way split, we're talking about incredibly small margins. So you're right, there's an effective digital strategy or more presence on the ground could swing a significantly statistically important proportion of the seats.
I mean, the question for the Labour Party is where is the Labour Party? Because if it historically has always had its Celtic redoubts, it's always had its areas to fall back on, which it did in the 1980s, which is why so much of its talent in the 90s and in the early 2000s came from Scotland and Wales.
Yeah.
But so it was dominated in Scotland, dominated in Wales, in the aftermath of the Thatcher era. So it's on the run in both of those places, and it's almost destroyed in Scotland. It now is under pressure in the north. Difficult for the Tories,
Pressure. Isn't it right that Labour has never won a majority, really, in England? A sustainable majority?
No. I mean, yes, it's correct. It's inconceivable. Well, anything could happen in this crazy election, but it is inconceivable that Labour could put together an overall majority while having almost no seats in Scotland. It just doesn't add up.
But for example, That's why I asked the question, is who has most room for improvement? Because with all these parties, each of them has to, bar the SNP, each of the main parties, Lib Dems, Labour and Tories, they all have to, in some degree, redraw the electoral map as it has been understood. And it's the party that can effectively do that that wins the election. But, you know, so it's like, you know, there's a good comparison in America where in 1964 the electoral map was redrawn by Johnson, where the Democrats had never really won in the cities and in the north, and the Republicans had dominated, while the Democrats had always dominated in the deep south. But Johnson, because of a range of things, civil rights acts and things like that, was wiped out in the deep south by Goldwater. But Goldwater didn't win enough in the deep south to get him through, but Johnson managed to construct a national coalition that brought him office. But it's just this, and it was based on quite fine margins.
But I love these moments of realignment and reconfiguration. A lot of people, I mean, people are at Westminster. We're recording this, Parliament is breaking up today, and after the stuff on the speaker yesterday, people are quite depressed in a way after the chaos of the last year or so. But politics is supposed to be competitive, and they're going into an election in which actually, unusually, several hundred seats could change hands. The Lib Dems could make advances in one place and then lose out in other places. The Tories could. The Tories are having to, and I think this is potentially one of the great things about our politics. I won't be saying this if it ends up with no overall control and hung parliament again and total chaos and no one really in charge. But so park that thought. But it is, at least the process of Brexit is forcing the Conservatives, partly out of cynicism, but partly it's genuine, I think, the sum of them, is forcing them to look to other parts of the country and talk to other parts of the country, what they would have thought of as the periphery, the kinds of towns
where... The blue-collar worker.
Precisely.
Which so many people like Robert Halfen have been actually urging them to do for the last 15, 20 years, but they never woken up to it. But we're missing Brexit Party in this, because if you look at just about every seat profile, every time you put the Tory and the Brexit vote together, they've got a clear majority.
Yeah.
Then I think you could see a big 10, 20, maybe even 30 seats. So what do we think's going to happen? Already 20 Brexit Party people have said they'll stand down?
Yeah.
Do you think that's the sort of way that Farage is allowing it to happen? He doesn't have to stand up and say, I've done a deal, I'll help you.
Well, I do wonder, part of me wonders whether he's staging a phased withdrawal, wanting to get some sort of pledge out of Johnson in the manifesto, saying that Johnson would consider no deal, back to all that stuff again, rather than exclusively backing the deal. It doesn't sound like much of a distinction to me, but Farage could present that as a victory. So maybe he's looking for that. But that's not the story of the last week, 10 days, is of Farage and his fellow bad boys of Brexit, that hilarious sort of naff name that the group gave themselves of Aaron Banks, Andy Wigmore, Richard Tice, who's the chairman of the Brexit Party, and Farage, that they were the alternative to Vote Leave. They were the unofficial campaign, and various books were published charting their not very amusing antics globally and their connection with Trump and all the rest of it. Well, they're split. Banks has switched and has fallen out with Farage and has tweeted rather colourfully, actually, and rather amusingly about his criticism of Farage. Wigmore also thinks that a deal should be done.
Well, and saying that they back Boris's deal.
Essentially, yes, it's imperfect.
Yeah.
I mean,
but
what? I mean, any Brexiteer, in my view, any Brexiteer who's lived through the events of the last year and who can't see now that if you don't take this Boris version of Brexit, there's, I don't know what you get as an alternative, but I mean the chances of you ever getting
probably actually
it's probably revoke and political
and Joe Swinson
chaos.
Number 10.
I'm not sure I'd go that far, but
well, strange.
I mean, the country's in
happened.
Trouble, but maybe not that much trouble yet. But it's so they're split, and Farage has gone ahead this week and launched his candidates. Mm. But as you said, Maggie, already 20, and I think more, are standing down. And then there's a process going on in Brexit Party land in which people who are used to being sort of told what to do and what to think by Farage must be coming under huge amounts of pressure from their friends and families and on social media, with people saying to them essentially, don't be an idiot.
Yeah.
If you look at, and Farage has now switched his argument to, he's trying to take on the Labour Party, that his focus is no longer the Tories.
Do a deal on the 150 seats, doesn't he say there are 150 Labour seats that the Tories have no chance of ever winning, and that he should go for them. Mm. Well, that actually would be very smart.
But Farage's critique would be that he tried, and Tice did try, over the course of the summer to do a deal with Boris, and that they couldn't get Boris to listen because Dominic Cummings hates the Brexit Party and loathes Farage and thinks that an association with the Brexit Party would taint the Tories. Mm. Personally, I still maintain that there was something that they could have done that was an informal arrangement, probably around 20 seats. I think Farage ultimately wants a seat in the Lords. I think I think he wants the kind of bragging rights and the right to go to
the
bar.
Despite the fact that he says he wouldn't be happy with mere baubles, and he's been offered twice.
Absolute nonsense. I think he wants to go to the bar in the Lords and order a pint, or go to the nice tea room. Mm. And order a gin and tonic,
you know,
and smile.
I thought you meant the
remain
bar
appears.
Is in the Inns of Court.
Inns of Court.
No, I meant the
actually,
bar serving alcohol.
You know, the great mistake that the Conservatives made is that in June, post June 2016, they should have made him appear that year.
Yes.
There's no point now, in a sense.
I mean,
But if they'd just bought him on the inside of the tent there and then.
I'm not a Farage fan. Written critically about him for years. However, I mean, I think it was the point for me, the point at which they went for Dame Carolyn Fairbairn, just made that to me completely took the piss, in that it was clear that just about anyone who'd backed the Remain campaign or had a senior role in it was up for some form of honour. Now, of course, that I know was because of her CBI work, but the message was, if you were involved with Remain, the establishment was going to still hand out baubles. It just doesn't make any sense, considering the politics of the last 10 years in this country, for there not to be, out of the UKIP Brexit Party nexus, four or five peers. I mean, I go to the House of Lords occasionally to watch. There are some fantastic peers, but there are some absolute drongos in there as
not
well.
Too many. You need to halve it.
Yeah.
Electoral reform.
Yeah, exactly. It's been interesting with the Brexit Party, is that it's the tension that's been there all year between the two sides of their sort of slogans. They're the Brexit Party, but they wanted to change politics for good. Mm. And the European election made them think that they could do both at the same time, because, you know, there was this big populist wave. They topped it, didn't they?
Yeah.
But then they didn't do so well in Peterborough, and it was kind of a puncturing of expectations. And they were holding all these big rallies in the summer.
That was precisely because the vote was split.
Yeah,
wasn't
exactly.
it between the Conservative? That's exactly.
Yeah,
sort
it illustrates
of seat,
the point.
And let the Labour by a couple of hundred.
I think Farage, because he is an egomaniac and because he's got carried away with this idea, I think he's failed to understand what was going on in the European elections. A lot of Tory voters voted for the Brexit Party, really just to give them a kick and to say, can it conceivably be the case that you're still sticking with Theresa May after everything that's happened?
It was a warning to the Tory Party.
Pretty obvious,
very isn't it? Simple. Yeah.
If you like Brexit and it hasn't happened, and there's a thing called the Brexit Party,
yeah,
it's not difficult to read the psychology.
Yeah.
But it was also interesting just seeing. I saw some footage from the rallies in the summer, and it was sort of Farage being introduced to, with, in a very American style, like things being, scriptural sayings being beamed up onto. The kind of big boards come into rock music and trying to replicate that whole Trumpian populist atmosphere.
Yeah.
You know, and in doing so, trying to. So it's this notion that it's what happened with Macron as well, is you suddenly just ignite people's instincts and perceptions and it carries you somewhere. But it was all contingent on Brexit, really, and it's kind of unfolded. But,
can I ask you a question? If you were Boris Johnson and the Conservative Party now, today, starting your campaign, would you spend more time going through your promises and what you want to change, or really attacking viscerally Corbyn, the cost of nationalisation, the theft, which will property rights, which if he either takes, you know, the promise to take over 10% of all public companies, the buy-to-let, you know, the tenants will have to if you own a second property, you have to sell it at them, not necessarily the market price. All these things that we know, as you said, are there in detail, but tactically it's an interesting one, isn't it? Yeah. Which way would you go?
But the problem is that all that stuff, bashing that aggressively, you know, the kind of Labour isn't working stuff, works when Labour had been in for 4 years and were clearly mucking up the economy. But I think people are complacent.
Yeah.
And I probably have been feeling the pinch for 10 years after the financial crash. And I think, you know, it's what happened in 2017. I think a lot of people probably voted against their, you know, proximate economic interest to give a kicking to a party they regard as a complacent rabble. Who have mucked up, for example, the police, or mucked up things that made them feel housing, or made them more insecure. So, I don't. On Corbyn, I think that there's a degree to which the attack line stuff doesn't really matter, as long as you are able to harness onto the structural change potentially, which is that more working class people will vote for you to get Brexit done. And that is the sole thing that matters in this election, because I just don't see how people will vote really for this, again, farrago of random commitments to increase spending on the NHS and police.
There's a danger for the Tories is that if they want this to be a Brexit election, because their offer is relatively straightforward. I mean, what happens after Brexit is not necessarily straightforward, but I do think there's a chance it could be more of a second-order event and just not dominate everything in the way that it does now. But still, they want to stick to a get Brexit done narrative and then try and deflect criticism by going on increased spending on the NHS, police numbers, that sort of stuff, because they're worried about the attack line. The danger is for them is that governments really don't get to decide what elections are about, because they can be far more disciplined than they were last time, and they can have a far more convincing campaign. As someone who actually really likes campaigning and likes being out talking to people, Boris Johnson compared to Theresa May, and still you can be blown off course by random news stories which haven't happened yet, or something going wrong in the NHS, or something
Jennifer's
connected to immigration, or all of that
Gordon
stuff.
Gordon Brown's
Gillian Duffy thing. That may not change the course of the campaign, but it's going to be difficult for the Tories to try and keep the story as they want it. They'll try and do a bit of both. And one of Boris's great selling points is that he's endlessly optimistic and that he's a patriot, so that they will be, I think you'll see quite a lot of appeal to, not appeal to flag, appeal to a notion of British / English patriotism, because they know that's such a weak point with Corbyn. Corbyn's allegiance is to a kind of wishy-washy activist global perspective, which
International Communist League type,
all of that stuff. I mean, that's the story of his politics and why his interests are not really economic. They are their foreign policy. McDonald's a different matter. McDonald's fixation is class war and destruction of the market system, but he's perfected a way of smiling about it and pretending that it's something else. So I think you might just see something quite sort of gutsy, and people will say it's populism, but I think when Boris is out and about, I think it will it'll have a patriotic, they'll attempt to create this sort of patriotic feeling around his campaigning.
And, you know, that helps by the inability of Labour to frame their Brexit policy, which is effectively to elevate Labour Party process to the international stage and just see what unfolds. So, you know, Laura Pidcock said today something like, we are not the party, you know, we're the party of What was it? We're not the party of Leave. We're not the party of Remain.
We're the party of both.
Yeah, we're the party of both. Yeah. Which I thought was just, there's a odd kind of beauty about that, but it was just utterly fatuous.
I mean, it's funny. I was just watching, and it's interesting the way in which media has changed even since 2015, 2017. And I was watching, just this morning, I sort of got up with a thought about listening to Labour's position on Brexit. I thought, maybe there's a kind of logic to this. So political class, media class, engaged people are saying this doesn't make any sense. Maybe they have actually got themselves a position where they can park it and say, you'll decide. And there's a quick renegotiation which inserts customs union and workers' rights, and then that'll be put to the punters and you decide. And I was thinking, well, maybe we've got this slightly wrong. And then I watched Keir Starmer on Good Morning Britain with Susanna Reid.
Oh, yeah.
Not Kay Burley, with Susanna Reid and Piers Morgan. Mm-hmm. Now, it crystallised something for me, because Keir Starmer got into a terrible mess. And she cut through all the policy wonk nonsense about how the policy would work and said, essentially, what do you believe? If I'm voting for you in your constituency, do you want to leave the European Union or do you want to remain? Now, you know that the answer is to remain in Keir Starmer's case, but he can't say it. So he was skewered rather beautifully in a way that reminded me of old school, maybe mirror or classic express style populist journalism, where they got right through the heart of all the nonsense, all through the nonsense of the political class. And it made me realise also what a powerful programme that is going to be during the election campaign, because they're a very good pairing for a start, Morgan and Reid, and they utilise social media brilliantly. So everything that they do, whether it's beating up Keir Starmer or it's forensically taking apart a Tory front bencher, is instantly clipped, and a minute is then put on social media and picks up views and turns into a story itself. Keir Starmer being beaten up this morning is still running as a social media play, and it's spread virally.
Yeah. Well, it's like that Winston Churchill debate they had with the chap who claimed that Winston Churchill was a white supremacist or something like that.
Yes.
And it drove a massive discussion in lots of intelligent places.
Yeah.
Just through a 3-minute clip.
Yeah.
That was seen by millions on social media. Just coming to the Lib Dems.
Yeah.
I suspect that they won't do quite as well as people think. Partly because what they've done over the past, so there's a proximate reason, which is that over the last few days you've seen one of their strategies is to frame Jo Swinson as a kind of Hillary Clinton character. This thing, I'm with her, why don't they debate her, the boys are running scared, is sort of front and centre. Even the campaign imagery they've used, it shows her as a US presidential candidate looking off to the left with an arrow. And I just think that sounds ludicrous.
It's not very English.
No,
and
exactly.
I think they've rather forgotten that we've had the first greatest prime minister, a female of all time, in Maggie Thatcher. So to try and present this, that the media or the political class are against, or voters are against female prime ministers, it's just nonsense. It just makes her look like a first-year university student debating.
But they're really stuck in a fork, people who want a Remain majority to emerge, because the Lib Dems obviously want to be the party of Remain and Revoke, and they'll probably do quite well in the south of England. But that you can see a situation where plenty of people who voted Labour at the last election, in Labour Tory marginals, vote for Labour because the MPs are probably quite, maybe they're well liked in London. Mm. They're all campaigning on Remain tickets. So you saw yesterday the shadow disability minister, front bencher, has removed all mention of Corbyn from her campaign literature. Mm. She's endorsed by Sadiq Khan, who's one of them, I think, polls very well with Remainers in comparison to other Remain sort of figures. And she's made it all about, I support a people's vote, which is exactly in the situation which Keir Starmer would like to find himself in, but can't.
Yeah.
So you could see a situation where the the Labour-Lib Dem split kind of works the Tories' favour. And there's loads of key marginals, whether it's Canterbury or Kensington, where the Tories could effectively get in a kind of SNP situation with the SNP union
majority.
Yeah. But if
the Remain Alliance hasn't really flown yet. You've seen Best of Britain compiling.
No, that's true. But the campaign hasn't really started. So you're probably going to get a wave in the next week to 10 days of stories of parties standing down or dirty deals where they put up a paper candidate but don't really campaign. So that I think that story is to come. I mean, on the Lib Dems, if you look at the London polling, which is in the Evening Standard tonight, and it is, I mean, Corbyn is having, I stress again, it's early days, but it's having a nightmare in London. Mm. And he seems to be being eaten alive in outer London, where there seems to be a swing towards the Tories in a Brexity way in certain seats like Dagenham. And that'll suit Boris in Uxbridge, where he only has a majority of 5,000, remember. But through that sort of corridor of Lib Dem seats and Tory seats, which are the Lib Dems are targeting, places like Wimbledon or Putney, you've got to expect on the back of Remain that the Lib Dems are going to storm through, and then somewhere like Emma Dent Coed, the seat where Grenfell happened. Mm. She's only got a majority of 20, and they've put in Sam Giemer there, who's a defector. So that's going to be fascinating. What we don't know about the Liberals is whether it can clearly replicate in very, very Remainer, very middle class seats where people are furious with the Tories and they really hate Boris.
And now, they could not vote Labour.
And they couldn't vote Labour. So the way to kick the government is to vote Lib Dem. Mm. Are there masses of those seats across the south east of England? I doubt it. There are probably going to be one or two, or obviously the Tories are in massive trouble in Winchester. Yeah. Though Winchester's one of those seats where the voters are permanently unhappy with whoever's in.
The thing is about this election is one or two or three seats for the Tories is potentially changes the picture. Because they're walking on such a fine path elsewhere in the country. And, they need a majority. It doesn't have to be an enormous majority. Yeah. It just has to be because of the turnover MPs, Boris is likely to have a much less rebellious few years if he gets majority. It just has to be, three or four.
I think they're saying nine, isn't it? Yeah. Nine more than last time.
Can we just talk a little bit about the leaders? You mentioned Swinson. Now, I must put my hands up and say that I find her... I find her TV and radio persona quite difficult. Speaking to someone who'd been doing some focus groups, she seemed to record as most people didn't know who she was, and quite a lot of the people who did know who she was found that she grated. So the stuff that you described very well, Alistair, about I hadn't thought of it in those terms. It is a Hillary Clinton approach that I don't think that might work in Putney and a few other places. I can't see it being a phenomenon that catches fire. They're also, if you look at their national polling numbers, they're slipping. So she looked to me when she was on TV the other night calling everyone else a sexist and demanding the right to be on the ITV debate with Johnson and Corbyn. It just smacked of desperation. It smacked of someone trying to make as much noise as possible to say, look, I'm still here. Corbyn looks... I walked past him in the House of Commons yesterday, in Portcullis House, and looked very fired up, and is a really good campaigner. As we, I mean, that's what he likes. That's what he likes doing.
There is one politician who does play the boys are nasty kind of role, which is Nicola Sturgeon, and she's very good at it. And much more, and much cleverer, and an authentically sophisticated person. Has interesting views on things. Is able to speak eloquently. I've never seen Nigel Farage. It's a weird thing to say, maybe, but I've never seen Nigel Farage more in greater difficulty than when I saw him debate against Nicola Sturgeon in a leaders' debate. Very good at kind of just unpicking the kind of the blokiness and the fatuousness of it all and the kind of act. So she's very good at that, and I just don't think Swinson, you know, speaking as, you know, she's not, she's really a product, this might sound mean, so sorry, Joe,
oh, go on.
But she's a product of the fact the Liberal Party was decimated in 2015. There was a massive turnover of very good MPs. So the Liberal Party did not exist in the form that it had done in the noughties, which where it had maybe a small number of very talented MPs, whether it was David Laws or whoever. It didn't exist in that form, and it, and Swinson is, and Farren before her, is a product of the lack of talent.
True.
There.
I agree. And you know, other than Brexit, revoke, you know, can any of us in one hand name any of their other policies?
But no.
I mean, I know it's not relevant to this, but it just shows, I think, that there's a there's an emptiness at the heart of the party, and that's why she was able to
come through. I don't think if you so if you saw Swinson getting into difficulty with Andrew Neil on Andrew Neil's programme on BBC Two, it did bear out the analysis, which even some of her colleagues will admit, is that she doesn't really do policy detail. She has for most of her career done a good routine in sort of generalist virtue signalling, and general elections find people out. The tricky thing for Sturgeon is that, and of course, I mean, the SNP start with an extraordinary advantage in Scotland and are expected to do very well, but we'll see if it turns out quite as well as they think, and there's maybe a bit of hubris there on the nationalist side, but we'll see. Is that Sturgeon is now being, to an extent, rumbled south of the border. So go back just a couple of years when she was fresh-faced after Salmond. She got very, very easy press down here and broadcast interviews which were very soft, generally. And she wouldn't be interviewed by people who were more difficult or challenging and robust. Again, back to Good Morning Britain, she was on that. She almost got away with it, with her claim. She was under pressure from Piers Morgan, saying essentially, you said that this would be once in a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And she said, no, I said once in a generation. She did actually say once in a lifetime when she was talking about the 2014 referendum. Now, she was being put under a form of pressure, which 2 or 3 years ago she probably wouldn't have been south of the border. So she's gone from being a bit of a progressive star in England to, I think she's going to get a much tougher time
nationally.
She just
comes with a hectoring hack at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, yes, there's
something about, but Ian Blackford and Sturgeon together, to say the sort of whole relationship between England and Scotland is really quite vicious now, poisonous, and I think,
well, I feel,
I don't know how you get over that.
Originally she benefited from the fact that she wasn't Alex Salmond, and I think English voters probably found Alex Salmond, I don't know, I'm not an English voter, but they probably found him an infuriating person.
I mean, the best clip of the election so far is the clip from Nicola Sturgeon on Saturday afternoon at the independence rally in George Square, where she says, shouting that she seeks a Scotland which is welcoming, inclusive,
diverse.
It? It's just her face is contorted while she's doing it, and then she says, and no Tory is going to stop this. I mean, the contrast between
it's
the
lost
words
its meaning,
welcoming,
actually, now, hasn't it almost lost its meaning, because she's so prejudiced. This is not an open debate anymore,
but
she's got a closed mind.
It's where serious Scottish nationalism is just, it's a bit like what's happened to liberalism in England. It's sort of become very empty, because the serious nationalists in Scotland, whether it was Neil Asherson or whoever, were aware that Scotland had very bad problems with sectarian violence, plus very bad treatment of immigrants in the post-war period. Lithuanians were treated like absolute dog shit in communities. Italians faced real problems. Polish people faced real problems. Asian people faced real problems, because and that's small numbers of people. This is the country.
You can't talk about my country and its moral superiority complex
like
that.
This is the country of, you know, which embraced Calvinism more than any other European country. And but I'm speaking as a Scot, who I find that fascinating about Scotland is this awareness always that you're kind of your own worst enemy, which is the real horror of being Scottish. Sometimes is you can blame the English for your problems all you like, fundamentally, you know that there's something wrong with us, that we're hubristic, we're damned, we, you know, have awful national traumas like Culloden and Glencoe, which were inflicted by our fellow Scots.
Argentina 1978.
Yeah. Highland clearances were done by, you know, Lowland Scots. You know, so there's this.
You see, I think we overdo it. I was faced with this choice, writing, and I think even that discussion is all about the Scots trying to romanticise their position unnecessarily. And I was faced with this choice of writing a book about RBS and talked to a lot of friends about it and various historians, and because I thought I could have at one point gone down a route of saying, because of what happened with the Darien scheme and because of Scotland's particular experience in the Reformation, there's something intrinsically excitable, hubristic, over-optimistic, and then comes the crash and damnation, and then the
deep
regret.
Deep in the psyche, deep in the sort of
now,
Scottish.
I concluded in the end I wasn't going to go down that route because I think, and even someone who I thought, a historian who I thought would buy into that, said, we talked about it for a long time, going through England's experience of similar events. I mean, so Scotland has the Darien scheme, England has the South Sea bubble. I don't think there's something intrinsically tragic or romantic or doomed about the Scots, although we would like to pretend there is, because it makes us, as Billy Connolly would say, windswept and interesting.
But there was an obsession in nationalist thought treated that seriously, at least tried to treat it seriously, which is what I found shocking about that Sturgeon speech, because, you know, having grown up in Edinburgh, I don't think of it as this diverse, welcoming country in the south as this nationalist. I mean, England is so much more multicultural than Scotland, for example. You know, so it doesn't even need to, it's so banal that you shouldn't have to be stated. But the Sturgeon comment is so banal. You think that it couldn't come out of the mouth of someone who I think is very intelligent.
So we conclude.
So we're going to make predictions.
Well, we conclude by saying that England's great. So Scotland.
Wales, so we love Wales.
And we love Northern
Wales.
Ireland.
Yeah, we do. And we love rugby even more.
We're not going to mention the rugby. But
predictions?
Predictions.
We can change it each week.
There's not much of a prediction.
I think England will win in 4 years' time.
I was talking about election, actually, but okay. Yeah, I'll go with you that on the rugby,
Predictions? Mm. Well, it's, you know, I think the only prediction I'll make is that the Tories are going to do a lot better in Wales than they have previously.
Okay, that's fair enough.
There we are. Mm. I think that's a pretty solid bet.
Not really making a prediction, but the Tories have a very... I think they can win. I think they can win a majority of 20 or 30, but it's quite a narrow path to victory that involves three or four things going right simultaneously, which is quite difficult. They need to not collapse in Scotland. They need to outperform in the north of Wales and then knock over a whole bunch of stuff in parts of the north and into the Midlands. And they need to hold on in the south. And they need weird things to happen in London. If that happens, they win by 20 or 30.
Yeah. You've seen Carrie Symonds has been going up to the northeast, helping canvass on some of those marginal seats. Quite a big...
If the Tories come a cropper, it might be because... And in a way, you know, they've got to go and do that. They've got to campaign because they're looking for votes in blue-collar seats. Mm. It does smack a little bit sometimes of, oh, bugger, we seem to have pissed off a lot of middle-class people in the south. Where are some seats? Yeah. Oh, yes. Look, okay, there's some blue collar seats. But that's politics. But they might be accused of opportunism for turning up. But I think if they choose wisely on their candidates, and if it is a genuine manifestation of them trying to reach out to parts of Britain that not exclusively voted for Brexit but predominantly did, then that's probably, I think, a positive. Positive part of the recalibration of British politics. But we should probably wrap things up there, shouldn't we?
Yeah, we should. Okay. You'll have noticed I haven't given my prediction.
Prediction just before we go.
I think it's mean to make people.
Lib Dems fewer than they think.
Yeah.
Tories more than they think. SNP, I think, will be fewer. Don't know why. I have a feeling. I think there's a turning against it.
Yeah.
And Labour, I don't know.
We'll see. If you have enjoyed this podcast, go to www.reaction.life and hit subscribe. It's only £52 for the year, £5 per month. You get my weekly newsletter, and you get fantastic stuff from Maggie and Alistair and the rest of the Reaction team. You also get invites to events, and our next event is coming up. It's an election event special, which is on the 20th of November. That's Wednesday, the 20th of November. It's me in conversation with the great John Curtis, who
Professor
John Curtis, who will be right at the heart of things on election night, where he effectively calls the, or he and his academic colleagues call the exit poll. And he's one of the country's most trusted leading commentators on politics polling. I've known him for a long time. We first worked together, I think, on the first devolved Scottish elections in 1999, and we'll be in conversation for an hour. There are welcome drinks before it. So go to the site to events. It's on Event B, and buy a ticket. Thank you very much for listening.